From Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, this is East Central Europe Past and Present. Occasionally, we invite visitors to our campus to present their work on East Central Europe and interact with students. And this blog series brings you their views on the past, present, and future of the region and how scholars approach it. Today, I'm talking with Jeremy King, Associate Professor of History at Mount Holyoke College and author of the book Budweiser's Into Czechs and Germans, A Local History of Bohemian Politics from 1848 to 1948, which was published by Princeton University Press in 2005. So I'd like to start out by asking a very general question about what brought you to this field and how your approach to it has changed over time.
Thanks, Holly. I don't really remember how I got to this field in the details, but I do know that it was by accident. My mother sent me and my brothers to language camps in Minnesota when I was a kid, and I did some Spanish and did some Russian. I did a fair amount of Russian, and then I did a fair amount more Russian when I was in boarding school from the ages of 14 to 18. So by the time I got to college, I had lots of Russian, and I just kept on. I think at some point in my sophomore year, I realized that I didn't particularly have much interest in Russia, so maybe I should try to make a lateral move. And I tried something with Polish, and then I tried Czech in the summer school as I continued my Russian. And I liked that. I had a good teacher. It was a one-on-one thing. That was about 1983, and when I continued the following semester, it was with Hanna Demetz, who had been teaching Czech at Yale for a long time. And she had a small cohort, maybe 3-4 people, and she was great. I got to know Hanna Demetz very well before she died in the late 90s, and I visited her a number of times after she retired to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. So anyway, I started working on Czech, and in 1984, when I was a sophomore in college, I got a fellowship that took me to Czechoslovakia and to Turkey for the summer, and I had a great time. So that was how I slowly got into the field, and I had to make a choice between the Eastern Mediterranean and East Central Europe, which took me a while. It wasn't really until the late 80s that I finally settled and abandoned things Turkish. But that was how I got into the field. And you said, what was the other part of the question about how I got, how my view has changed?
Yeah, how your approach to it has changed over time.
Well, I think that it's never really been constant. When I came in, the part of the profession that I came into was, well, my undergraduate and my graduate education was with a cohort of European immigrant male professors of a certain generation and type, and they were marvelous lecturers. They had a sort of nonchalance about their knowledge. But there was also a lot of the national folded into it in a way which made it all self-evident. So anything more, what would you call it, reflective or reflexive, which took a look at some of the assumptions that went into writing history, that came more on the side and without much direction from any professors. And I think that took me quite a while, more, a lot longer than it would have taken if I'd had a different program of study and I'd had people who were pushing certain things on me more. Whether it be Foucault, which is already really ancient, but that was about as far as things got, right? More recent and maybe follow-on sorts of views. So anyway, the national qualities of everything were absolutely self-evident, and it was, I guess, pretty much assumed that the only thing to write about when it came to the region was things national. And I think that I was a part of a set of people who for various reasons and from various backgrounds, helped to pick that apart a bit. And already when I finished my book, the first book, which is actually published in 2002 and then reissued in 2005 as a paperback, I thought that I should move on to something non-national. And that was my plan, but then things just didn't work out that way. So now I think that I probably really and truly will in the next year or so. I've got some late socialist and post-socialist ideas. I'm interested in property. I'm interested in cultural understandings of property. So that would be another change. I think that I've been there and done that with the national. And I'm interested in, well, what Peter Judson would call depathologizing the national violence there, but maybe pathologizing the region in new and interesting ways.
So new pathologies. I think it's interesting this step that your generation in particular took, that in order to move us beyond nationalism, I don't know quite how to put it, but you had to you know, dance with nationalism one last time. And I would like for you, if possible, to reflect on how you see your own work as a kind of transition from national to post-national history, or if you see it like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it brings to mind what you said about dancing one last time in Bakke, the big Supreme Court case in the United States from 1978. There is this line to the effect that in order to get beyond race, you've got to take account of it. And I think that there is something like that. And it goes right back, you know, not only to Bakke, but of course, but to the way that the Habsburg state itself dealt with these national problems. That, like the Social Democrats in the old monarchy, everybody had more interesting things to do, but they just kept on feeling that they had to just take care of this bothersome problem first, and then they could get on to the real issues, whether it be class or something else.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that my book is a transitional piece. There was work that was being done in the 90s and that came out sort of at the end of that decade, the beginning of the new millennium, which played with these issues. For example, Peter Judson's Exclusive Revolutionaries and other things which have followed since. And what was the question? How, whether it's transitional? When I remember when my book came out in 2002, there was a review of it.
Your book came out in 2002? Did I say 2005?
You said 2005.
I'm sorry.
Is the book. Yes, fine.
I'm sorry.
That when Stephen Beller reviewed it, in the Times Literary Supplement, he had I think he understood it, and he was very generous in his review, but ultimately he couldn't agree with it, and I think that there was a line there somewhere that, you know, King has just gone too far, you know, that that this is really, you know, we can't accept this, that this is some sort of sticking out on a limb with no evidentiary basis, and you know, how can he claim that the national was not really there as much as it was. And that's all deeply ironic now. When you take a look at Peter Judson or Tara Zahra, or for that matter Jim York, and their work more recently, I think that the substance of what they've done and what other people have done as well is to say that King didn't go far enough. So, you know, that would fit in with historiographical trends that people would pursue an advantage or take a point and extend it. And I thought I was extending it pretty far, but now when I look at how that book hangs together after something like 8 or 10 years, I think that I probably didn't go far enough, and I think that I still was to some degree prisoner of some of the national rhetoric that I was trying to get some distance on. So, I think that there's a lot of room on that limb yet for people to go out before it breaks. And things did start to move. You could take a look at it another way, that there was a whole sort of slew of books that, well, not a slew, but there was an important set of books that came out in the early 80s. There's Anderson, right, Imagined Communities, and there was Hobsbawm, which I think came out in the same year, and there was Verdery, Catherine Verdery's book on Transylvanian villagers, which didn't get as much play. It might have gone paperback, but I don't know. Certainly it didn't get read as widely, but it was part of a set of books that started cracking these questions open. And I think that people in the 90s, among whom would be me, we were responding to that. Right? And you could go back before 1983, and you could look at all sorts of stuff from the 60s, which is really when Gellner, Gellner's book is also from 83, but his goes back really to the early 60s. So you could keep on leapfrogging back and see that there's a pretty continual chipping away at the old block.
Mm-hmm.
What was it, the 1966 conference in Indiana, which was so important, where various people from Central and Eastern Europe came to the United States and focused on the national question so exclusively that people started to get uncomfortable. Sort of various questions raised about where the heck is the government in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe it goes all the way back to then, but I think that, now we're, we've got some, how would you call it, more clear paths forward, and people are much more conscious about what they're doing when they write about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that struck me when I was rereading your book, that, you know, recently, is that one of the things that appears to have died or has not been picked up in subsequent literature is this idea that there are alternative loci of identity formation. That's, you know, you talk about the Budweisers in your book, and now the rhetoric seems to have turned, and correct me if I'm wrong, but towards an idea of an absence of national categories rather than towards the presence of other identity possibilities. And so, like Deák writes in Beyond Nationalism about an alternative kind of officer corps identity, and you talk about Budweiser's, but the subsequent work like Zara and Judson in particular talk about national indifference.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, I don't see much in their work of trying to recover alternative forms of identity. And I was wondering if you see it the same way, or how you would account for this shift if you do see it in this way.
No, I see what you're saying, and I agree to some extent with what you're saying. I don't think that the way that I framed it, which was to talk about some sort of Habsburg loyalty, which was complex and included local components, I don't see that as in the least bit incompatible with the way that, above all, Judson and Zahra, but also Bjork have pushed things with the expression national indifference or nationally indifferent, which actually shows up at the time. I don't see any incompatibility there at all. I think that they are different ways of addressing the same thing. But I do agree that the way that it's been pursued so far, there's a bit of still keeping a foot in the national. If I can be a little bit more explicit, explain what I mean. The work that Tara Zahra and Peter Judson have done has focused above all on national activists and has done some really good reading of national activists against each other, or looking at the repeated frustrations of nationalists to get at some sort of patterns which are really just hinted at. You know, so sort of the problems that nationalists complain about but don't want to explore too much in their implications.
Mm-hmm.
But the work of Jim Bjork, the Habsburg monarchy, but next door in Prussia, he looked actually at a non-national cohort. Right? Nothing like that has been done in the Habsburg monarchy. And I was just saying to you the other day, that I remember when I was in graduate school and I was talking with somebody who will go unnamed, who had this idea of doing a dissertation project on a cohort of late Habsburg imperial bishops, and decided after a fair amount of investment in that project to abandon it because it had no prospect of employment. It was better to go to something that concerned the Second World War. And as it turns out, he was right. So nobody has looked that I can think of at a particularly non-national cohort since, for example, István Deák looked at the officer corps, which is, there are even some problems with that particular cohort, because the name of the book, Beyond Nationalism, it could arguably be, you know, before nationalism, because that cohort, that social set of officers had a lot of very sort of archaic features, and it wouldn't necessarily be the best one to focus on as some sort of a place to find a living, responding, reacting, non-national way of looking at the world. So yeah, there's some sort of a strange gap there. I'm sure that someone somewhere right now is working on something like this, but I don't know it. The problem is, and I think that for example, Zahra, with her most recent article, which came out this month in Islamic Review, is very aware of this issue. And you know, the way that she talks about it is that there's not any there. There's no nationally indifferent party, right? There's no group of people who are getting together on the basis of their opposition to national movements. Rather, the only consistency of these different cohorts, whether it be certain parts of the Jewish population of the monarchy, or certain aristocrats, or certain civil servants of higher levels, or the higher ranks of the Catholic Church, and so forth, they have mostly just been given an ideological consistency through the projections onto them by nationalists of certain anti-national views. So that you're not going to find some vast right or left-wing conspiracy here. You're just going to find a set of, you know, what I think would consist of local, particularist, or institutionally specific ways of looking at the world, which just don't put the nation at the center. So maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe that's why people haven't invested so much in coming up with a particular cohort or set of cohorts and following it through time as they deal with, you know, ever better organized, ever stronger national movements, pushing their view on the public. Well, period. So, yeah, there is a, how'd you call it, a theoretical development of national indifference, which has really come very far, right? I didn't go far enough. I went too far, and no, I didn't go far enough. But we don't really know that much still about, nobody has really come up with a really good set of primary sources that would allow us to think this through anew from the other side of the fence, from the non-national side of the fence.
Oh, you mean that we only get to the non-nationals through the nationalist activists so far?
Yeah, primarily.
Well, that's interesting. So one of the things that, you know, if we're moving, you know, if, let's say, we are moving into a post-national period of the historiography where we say, okay, we've got the thing about national indifference and now let's contemplate other issues, what aspects of this era, I mean, because a lot of the students who are just starting now and who will enter this field down the road will have to, or, you know, arguably should grapple with this period in the historiography where, you know, we sort of came to terms with the earlier preoccupation with the national and then sort of, I don't even know how to put it, sort of purged it through, you know, working through it very meticulously. So how should we teach the next generation of students about this, you know, about the national? Because, you know, obviously we can't, or, you know, maybe we can, but how should we deal with the national when we're teaching the next generation of students?
Gosh, I thought you were going somewhere else, Holly. I thought you were going to say, well, what else should we do?
Well, I'll ask that later.
Okay, well, all right, then I'll see if I can focus on the question at hand. Because the question of, well, what else should we be talking about in the region is I have a more sort of ready answer to that. But as regards some cohort which is coming of age now and has to deal with the national and the region so as to put it to one side, I think that I've got a little bit to say there, which is mostly to echo, I think, above all, Peter Judson, which is that there's a pathologization of the region, which is really deep, to the extent that there's any knowledge of this region at all in popular culture in the United States or outside the region, it amounts to this, the sort of pathologization of violence, with sort of the Balkans being perhaps the worst, or at least the worst at certain points, right, and so forth. But that's this sort of the a really important or a predominant lens to look at the region, and it that's not to deny that there's any violence there, but I think some sort of more comparative work which normalizes what went on in the region and puts it into European or even larger frameworks and shows that there's nothing specifically pathological about this region. That would be important. It's easier said than done. I've been reading in a seminar this semester a variety of books which claim to do some of that. But, for example, The Butcher's Tale by Helmut Walser Smith is very conscious in its introduction about the need to avoid some sort of teleology when writing about a murder in a small town in Eastern Imperial Germany in 1900. Shouldn't we be careful to avoid letting the whole thing be shaped by our knowledge of what happened in the Second World War, above all the Holocaust? And yet, I think the book is fundamentally shaped by that in ways which distort it. The whole thing is boiled down to anti-Semitism and the Polish population in the region, which is just down the road. I mean, it's even just sort of completely intermingled. It's dismissed with a sentence or two. Mm-hmm. So to bring back in the national could, and here I think I might have something to say, there's a way that so much of the, well, the nationalists in the region are supposed to be pathological, but it's supposed to come out, you know, above all in anti-Semitism, which culminates in the Holocaust, mm-hmm. right? And I think that there's a possibility here to understand certain dimensions of anti-Semitism, which can be read, for example, in 1900 or in the 1920s as being steps along a crooked path to Auschwitz, as being actually more about getting caught in a national crossfire. Mm-hmm. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
So, for example, that's one of the things that I really like about Tara Zahra's work, Peter Judson's mm-hmm. work, Jim York's work, that all three of these books, I'm thinking Guardians of the Nation, mm-hmm. Kidnapped Souls, mm-hmm. and neither German nor Pole, all three are looking at some sort of a nationally divided terrain,
mm-hmm.
And the escalation of that tension over time in a non-teleological fashion, and all three acknowledge the presence in the mix of a small Jewish minority, but
mm-hmm.
they don't feel as though they must put the Jewish minority front and center so as to fit into the larger historiography which points towards the Holocaust. So of course you could criticize them for paying, you know, sort of not enough attention to questions of religious difference, which cut across questions of national difference. But I think that this is productive, right? To refuse to not use the same set of questions in all these different situations across the region, and to allow the material to speak and say, well, actually, here, in this particular case, we might just have something where the Jewish question is fairly ancillary.
Mm-hmm.
And I can give a good example of that. There was an article which came out just a few years ago in Slavic Review by Michael Miller
mm-hmm.
about Archbishop Cohn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great article. It's about an archbishop in Moravia in about 1900 whose last name was Cohn and whose grandfather was a convert from Judaism. And he had an unhappy and short term as archbishop because things went dramatically wrong during his term and he actually had to resign. He was forced by the Pope to resign. And I think that article is perhaps too, even though it never really goes beyond the 19-teens or at the latest the 20s, it is framed by the whole question of the Holocaust and of anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
But what if we just look at the situation of somebody whose last name happened to be Cohn and who was treated in anti-Semitic fashion as being caught up primarily in a Czech-German dynamic? And I think that would actually open up different ways of looking at that particular incident, or for that matter, with what Jim Bjork has done in other parts of the region. So, yeah, to avoid some sort of pathologizing, universalizing model, and to look at specific developments on the ground, in different parts of the ground, different times, and deal with it in its own terms, let the materials speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things with the teleology, and I think, you know, this speaks a lot to, like you said, the trends in the field that made it seem or actually be easier to get a job for a while working on the 20th century. I mean, I was certainly advised when I started graduate school to choose a 20th century topic, and that the teleology emerges partly out of, you know, the focus on episodes of violence that became researchable as a result of the opening of the archives. And one of the things that, in my mind, has kept historians of the 19th century from being in dialogue with the 20th century, you know, with historians of the 20th century, is something that you're looking at now, in my mind, and that's the territorialization of groupism, if you will, and it's basically independent statehood on the basis of self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you have a sense of how the stories that you have been telling about the Habsburg monarchy travel into the 20th century as a result of this change, you know, when it's no longer a dream to have a state, but that or in many cases they didn't even dream of having a state for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Or to have even territorially bounded area. How does territory or the groundedness of nationality affect some of the issues that that you've been exploring in the 19th? And I know that you know tons about the 20th century as well, so I'd like you to reflect, if you can, about what the territorialization of nationness does.
Could you put that another way? Could you reframe it?
Well, let me put something out there. Because I think a lot of things that are aspirational initially and that make it possible to spin certain ideas about the realm of the possible, once you have a territorial state, a lot of things become impossible very quickly. So it doesn't open up possibilities in my mind, it closes them off. And some of the ones that it closes off are the ones that some of the most radical thinkers would most like to pursue. And because being a territorial state means that you have to interact with other states,
mm-hmm.
and so you cannot exist in isolation, or you cannot just be a force that opposes. It's sort of like the dissident conundrum of the late communist period. And so because you're operating in a universe where other forces can push and pull, the realm of options that you have is limited, and is limited in ways that you are sort of forced to accept certain rules of play,
mm-hmm.
and rules of play that have to do more with geopolitics than with domestic politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm, you know, that's mostly, it's something that I've been thinking about, so I'm being rather mean in forcing you to think about it, but some of the readings that you assigned to the students for today speak to this problem of territory and how people have tried to get around it, to deterritorialize nationness, for example. And I think those projects are fascinating, and for their near implementation, but ultimate, you know, not even failure, they didn't really get much of a chance. But the fact that the terms were completely changed after the First World War is an issue that I find makes traveling across that particular boundary in terms of conceptually very difficult, because the universe that people emerge in 1918 is a very different universe. And so maybe the question is, you know, how can we make this, you know, traverse this boundary? And, you know, your book, I think, is neat this way because it's 100 years and it goes, you know, from 1848 to 1948. I think Tim Snyder's work also tries to do this. But, you know, the particular point that I'm most interested in right now is this 1918, 1920. Like, what does that do? you know, on the level of periodizing the region's history, but also on the level of conceptualizing what came before and what comes after.
Okay, I mean, I think that I can say something about that, at least, you know, fairly particularly, and maybe that would lead me to maybe understand the question a little bit better, but if you look at, well, so 1848 until, I don't know, the 1970s, it does seem to me that there is a set of constitutional arrangements which start out as pretty much internal, right? Sort of internal reworkings of the Habsburg monarchy. These are domestic affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's sort of the Civil War of 1848 and constitutional drafts and imposed constitutions and revoked constitutions. And then in 1867, some sort of really significant recrafting of the territory,
mm-hmm.
which involves a partition, a near independence for Hungary, some sort of, you could call it a federalization using already existing historical individual territories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then almost immediately a sort of a recrafting of that, at least for the Galician territory with some degree of autonomy. And so you've got what are called in German the Ausgleiche, various compromises, which are constitutional settlements. And then I, in my current work, have been looking at the sort of a whole crop of later so-called little compromises of about 1900 to 1914, which come back to really some of the same mechanisms or questions and change things a bit. So it goes more non-territorial.
Right?
Mm-hmm. People have, in 1848, they're talking above all about some sort of a territorial reconfiguration of the monarchy. Hungarians get their territorial chunk in 1867, Poles to some degree in just a couple of years later, and then there's a sort of a move, basically through stalemate, towards some sort of reconfigurations from federalization on a non-territorial basis, above all of Czechs and Germans leading the way, but also Germans and Italians, and the list goes on. And so then, you know, you go on, and you go after the war, and you see that a lot of this, of these techniques, of these documents, of the personnel who developed expertise in the management of difference within an imperial polity, it continues. And so far as I know, nobody has ever written about this. There might be just a little bit in Kahn back from the 1970s. Sturz knows a lot about it, but hasn't written explicitly on it.
Mm-hmm.
But what you see, so another, I can give an example of it, that Eagle Glasheim, in his book, which came out around the same time as mine, about noble nationalists,
mm-hmm.
he talks about German aristocratic nationalists from Czechoslovakia in the interwar period, who find themselves cast adrift. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They all of a sudden, the whole of their world has changed. And they drift in different directions and end up in different places. But he has a fascinating discussion of a cohort of them led by a prince from Czechoslovakia by the name of Rohan, who leads a group of like-minded people in trying to push the case for some sort of increase, improvement in minority rights for Germans in Czechoslovakia in front of the League of Nations. And goes beyond that and comes up with what he calls a minority statute, which he proposes that various states consider.
Mm-hmm.
This comes out in 1930. And it's deeply rooted, right, in the experiences of before the war. But now it's going to be concluded not between parliamentary factions, right, of Czechs and Germans in the Moravian Diet, but it's going to be concluded between, let's say, Poland and Germany. And it doesn't come about. 8 years later, so that's 1930, you see Henlein being coached from behind the scenes by Hitler propose an arrangement for reconfiguring Czechoslovakia, which is in a variety of ways based directly on the pre-World War I arrangements for national autonomy,
mm-hmm.
With both non-territorial and territorial components, and the whole thing being completely insincere. Right? And then it goes on. I mean, you take a look at what's happening in Yugoslavia at the same time, 1938-39, and various attempts by the royalist regime to come back yet again to the Serb-Croat question,
mm-hmm.
and cut a deal,
right?
To settle these problems. And of course, the problems are not settled, partly because war comes. After the war, and then you, of course, have written, I think, really wonderfully about the way that in the war, these mechanisms, these pre-World War II techniques and personnel continue, with your own emphasis being on a continuity between League of Nations mechanisms for dealing with national conflict within regions,
mm-hmm.
and Nazi management of Hungarian-Romanian conflict in occupied Transylvania. I'd argue that some of the League of Nations mechanisms go back directly to Imperial Austrian techniques,
mm-hmm.
before the war.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real personnel continuity there which nobody has explored. And then after the war, after the Second World War, if you take a look at what goes on in Yugoslavia right through the constitutional reforms of 1974, again, you've got a whole a radiation into new spaces and new contexts ever,
mm-hmm.
farther from the home turf of Imperial Austria, where people have acquired some expertise in these matters. And if you take a look nowadays at European Union policy, the various, what is it, framework mechanisms,
mm-hmm.
for dealing with conflict in Macedonia and elsewhere, people in the know, people on law faculties in European universities, they know very well that this came from Rudolf Laun and various other Austrian jurists from before the First World War. So that would be an example of how there are continuities that haven't been looked at. I'm not sure that really gets at your question. Maybe you can.
I think it does. I really appreciate what you said, particularly. It makes me want to look into some of the continuities, and particularly the Austrian side between the pre-World War I and the post-World War I scheming, which took place in a number of formats, and the League of Nations was one, but lots of people were spinning ideas. And no, I think that, that's definitely part of territorialization, which is, the small problem that I'm, smallish, that I'm interested in. So no, I think that was an excellent answer. So you are a person of exceptional linguistic capacity, and as a young upstart, I was very much inspired by the stories that I heard of you. In your book, you use Czech and German, but you also speak beautiful Hungarian and a number of Slavic languages. Plus, I just learned last night Turkish. And I just wanted to ask, you mentioned a bit that you have this early history with languages, but I wanted to ask how you feel your knowledge of these languages affects your research and your findings.
All right, that's a good question. First of all, I don't know Turkish. I've forgotten it. And I think that's probably true to some degree in my Hungarian as well. But it doesn't particularly worry me. I think that it'll come back. How does my language repertoire affect what I research? Well, it doesn't necessarily do that much. I'll say one thing that it does do. Well, I was going to say that in framing my dissertation project in my early years of graduate school, I did, first of all, acquire a language or two with an eye to what I had in mind. So it wasn't like the languages forced the topic. The ability to learn languages fairly quickly opened up topics. And so I came up with a project which was considerably more ambitious in one dimension than the book that eventually came out, Budweiser's, in the Czechs and Germans. The Budweis case was one of only three, and I actually carried out research in all three places, the Budweiser, Budjovice, and the Czech Republic today, Sopron, which is called Rüdenburg in German and is in Western Hungary, right on the Austrian border, and then Maribor, which used to be called Marburg an der Drau, which is today in Slovenia. So a Hungarian German speaking town and a Slovene German speaking town, as well as a Czech German speaking town. And that was the project. And as it turned out, as I got into the material, I realized that the literature, the historiographical literature, had assumptions that I had shared, and that in order to dismantle those, or at least begin to dismantle them, I simply couldn't spread myself as thinly over these three towns as I thought. So the research on Maribor and Sopron is still in a box. But I did learn Slovene for that, and I also played a fair amount with Serbo-Croatian, because there was material in Serbo-Croatian that I found useful. On the other hand, when I turned from that first project, which I pushed to completion, and I looked for a new one, I didn't pay attention to what languages I knew. I thought maybe I should get back to things Hungarian, but I just found the Austrian half of the monarchy with its legal experiments just before the First World War fascinating. So I turned to that, and I've been doing the compromises for a few years now. And to my disappointment, to some degree, I found that really the only language that I needed was German. My work in recent years has been overwhelmingly focused on German. The high courts, the law journals, the jurists in their various autobiographical and other writings, they tended to use German.
Mm-hmm.
And the level of it, the level of the discourse is very high. I mean, coming out of the Budweis project, I felt as though, obviously moving to a certain language takes you into its culture,
mm-hmm.
and the level of discourse in Czech at the time and at present, I think, in the current living Czech language historiography of the monarchy is completely elsewhere than it is in German or in English.
Mm-hmm.
So I've thought about, dipping into some of the popular press to give some sort of a popular perspective on some of what I'm looking at, but I've decided so far that that's really not the point, and I'm looking at structures, and we can maybe get to this, about questions of comparability with the United States, about deep structures of how liberal regimes deal with questions of racial difference, and I'm really not that interested in the reactions on the street. I'm interested in the reactions of small groups of men in courtrooms behind closed doors where they make really momentous decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that for that, the German is what I need.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's a peculiar German. It's a difficult German. I've enjoyed getting my hands around that. But I think that the possibility of acquiring and reacquiring languages is altogether open.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the Czech Republic last year for a whole year, a little bit more than a year, and I spoke and used and wrote Czech extensively. My Czech has never been better, so that at the ripe age of 46, it seems like some language brain cells are still alive. And I think that if need be, if I decided that I wanted to learn Romanian or Yiddish or Hebrew or whatever it might be, it would be possible on the basis of the prior experience. So it just means that I can pursue the topic wherever it might lead me, and I think I'll be pretty confident that languages won't take me too much time, and that I won't make mistakes of translation that are too grotesque.
I'm glad you mentioned this issue of structures, because one of the things that you and I have watched is the conceptual disappearance of our field in terms of what we used to call Eastern Europe doesn't really exist anymore, and when you say Eastern Europe it refers to things that aren't what we study, and the other names, we are deeply conscious of all of the politics that overlay those names, and increasingly this region, for better or worse, and some would say better because they want, if it's invisible, it means there are no problems, has become conceptually invisible, and particularly in terms of pedagogy, that it's if you recover it as a region, you're recovering a kind of dinosaur or a particular version of it and reifying it. And so the question is, you know, in this new world, how do we, or how should we relate to our field? And you mentioned the parallels with affirmative action in the United States. Should we be thinking in a more European, broadly European frame? Should we be thinking in a comparative frame? And is it important for students, undergrads, for example, to know where this region is and what goes on here? And if so, in what context?
Well, I've tried some comparative history. I had a sabbatical leave about 4 or 5 years ago where I spent an enormous amount of time trying to put together something comparative Austrian-American. And ultimately I decided it was not for me. Maybe it's for somebody else. The risk of some sort of potted history of working with stereotypes and ending up falling between two stools struck me as just so great. And so, I've tended to do things since then which are more asymmetrical, which if you look at my footnotes, you'll see that I'm drawing a lot of my ideas and my inspiration from people who work on American history. But then I make no reference to anything American except for its sort of a few sort of key points, really just by signaling that there's a possibility. And then I find that when people respond to my drafts, they find this inappropriate. They'd rather that we just maintain sort of barriers between these places. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with that, but I still haven't found some sort of a way to integrate it. But I do think that that's important to. For example, part of the de-demonization, depathologization of the region is to understand that this place was not a cauldron of ethnic violence, a place of tremendous backwardness. It was one of the outstanding examples in the last half of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, of a liberal state. With separation of powers, developed traditions of checks on the executive branch by the judiciary, for example, and just for one small example, which might not mean much to some people, but would to others, there's so much work just in the last 20 years as East Central Europe has come along. In following a certain kind of a liberal democratic model, the adoption throughout the region of constitutional courts. Well, where did the first constitutional court come into existence? In the continent of Europe, arguably in Austria in 1867 or immediately thereafter, with some forms of judicial review being in force before, some of the genuine equality before the law in force long before it was in the United States. So this place was not backward. It was actually really in the forefront. There's a great recent book by Paul Starr, a sociologist who's interested in liberalism, which is a real brilliant discussion of the British and American strands to liberal thought, which is tragically flawed because for all his deep knowledge of the traditions, these two pillars of liberal thought, British and American, he doesn't even know that the Austrian is out there. He doesn't know that anybody in the know in continental Europe would have to count Austrian liberal traditions as developed after, 1830-something, as right up there with the British and the American, which need to be brought in, for example, for the specific development of questions of group rights, of dealing with difference, which is so important to us in our times. So, I've sort of drifted away from the question. You were asking what? About how we counter the post-Cold War loss of relevance for the region. I think there's that. That there aren't that many of these places that can be compared with the United States and other liberal polities of Western Europe today. And to the extent that you can find something which is comparable but really quite different, from dealing 100 years ago, then that's all to the good, and yet it's been neglected. So that's one thing. Another is that what you say about sort of the way this has been lost. It's just a dinosaur, which is the revived. I feel that a lot. I started teaching a course on post-1945 Eastern Europe in the mid-90s, and I've come to the point now where it's really time to revise that course, because post-communism is now historically a distinct period. We can look at it, and to think that the world of, what is it, really existing socialism is gone. And to some degree, you could find it sort of echoes of it, which would be entertaining for students, in the way that large universities operate in the West, whether it be in the UK, the United States, right? So maybe it's not completely a dinosaur, but yes, it is. It's gone. You know, the whole world of really existing socialism is something which came and went. You know, in Ken Jowett's phraseology, some sort of a meteor hit, right? And the dinosaurs were wiped out. But what I miss, and it would be in part because I haven't immersed myself in the literature, but also I think because of the people who are writing this new literature, there's so little done about what these new liberal democratic states of Eastern Europe in the last 20 years have become. And the last year that I spent in the Czech Republic was an eye-opener for me to see the way that you have all the trappings, right, of a liberal democratic polity. Separation of powers, you have full equality of the vote, protection of the right to vote, and the whole of the liberal complement of rights. But when you actually get just a little bit closer to it, you see a judiciary which is powerless, an executive branch which is corrupt and deeply sort of tied in with various mafia types, and populism, which panders to the will of the majority while trampling on the rights of all sorts of minorities, most prominently maybe the Gypsies or the Roma. So we need to look at that. We need to take a look at the way that some classic ideas of Western liberal free market politics have been appropriated into the region in ways which entrench inequality, which make for perhaps down the road explosive tensions, because people are fed up with it and they sense in some sort of a way that they can't necessarily articulate that it's all false. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know of anything out there, certainly of a popularizing sort that would be in some sort of New York Times book review or something like that, which writes about what the experience is for people to live, to have imposed on them this particular, you know, piratical version of liberal democratic capitalist rule. Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of relevance in this region, and it's open. You know, so many students go nowadays to Prague and Warsaw and Krakow and Budapest without necessarily learning the languages, but some of them will, and some of them will acquire enough sort of language facility to be able to work on this region. And I think that that's one angle, is to look at the whole of the inflection of certain traditions that, or certain institutions that the United States and Western Europe share with this region now, at least supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
I'll stop there.
Okay, well, and that's a good segue to my last question, which loops back to something you thought I was going to ask before, which is, you know, what are the things to be done yet in this field? What should we be working on, and what should the students of the future be focused on that we've kind of missed, and that it's high time to look into?
I think that the problem probably... The question is probably one of those, what do you call it, a leading question. Everything should be examined. I mean, what's going to come up, and what's going to be done brilliantly is going to surprise us, because I don't really think that it's so much a question of what as how. I think that somebody will come along and do something brilliant in an unexpected field, and that's the way it should be. I do think that there's a public service that historians and other professional scholars can do in the region, which is to help untangle the ghosts of the communist past, especially. I suppose you could go back to the Nazi past as well, and people, of course, do. But the way that this is also alive today, and the way that it's been dealt with in a variety of ways, right, illustration and various trials, and then informally, right, on the street, and the rumor mill, and who did what to whom, and all that, it's really alive in these societies. And to explore it archivally, to work at understanding the mechanisms, and to make it accessible in a way which people in the region want to read.
Mm-hmm.
That strikes me as something which is really important. That would be a great civic service. I think that the EU is becoming more and more important in the region in ways which, for example, Andy Markovich has explored persuasively, the way that it's a sort of a useful whipping boy, a whipping post, right,
mm-hmm.
that various political factions inside these countries can blame the EU for politically unpopular decisions and then take those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important way that the EU works. You see all sorts of change coming with, you know, it's because of Brussels, right? So much more about that relationship. I could imagine that there'd be a fair amount. There already is stuff coming. Igor Glasheim's new project, among others, on the environment,
mm-hmm.
on the built and lived environment. I can see that all coming along. But really, I think that it's very, very possible that somebody will come along and do something unexpected and brilliant still in the field of nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much for taking time with us, and I hope that you'll come visit us again.
Thank you, Holly.